This is an FCIC interview with Pat Parkinson at the Federal Reserve Board. It is 8:30 a.m. on Tuesday, August 24th, 2010. If everybody could just introduce themselves.
That's an old already there.
Yeah. Could introduce yourself. So, Mr. Parkinson, my name is Chris Seifer. All of us are with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We are currently looking at the issue of systemically important institutions too big to fail, and in particular Lehman Brothers. And in our research and investigation, we've seen a fair amount of documents that you had the good fortune of being on, discussing the various options with respect to Lehman Brothers. And what we have seen, let me lay out this context, it may help you answer our questions. You know, of course, after Bear goes down in March of 08, there's an increased monitoring presence at Lehman Brothers and the other investment banks by the SEC and the New York Fed.
Right.
And there is a particular focus on liquidity, and within that, a particular focus on the tri-party repo market, since Lehman had a ballpark $200 billion mm-hmm. of collateral being financed through that market. And throughout the time period, and particularly from June through September, we see in those documents concerns about that, concerns about the assets, and consideration of various types of government assistance, including the government essentially stepping into the shoes of J.P. Morgan to provide intraday clearing or intraday credit on the tri-party repo market, consideration of a main lane one type vehicle with the government providing financing and other types of assistance. But of course, once we get through to Sunday night on the 14th, you know, the decision is made to not provide any of that assistance, and Lehman files bankruptcy early Monday morning on the 15th. So with that backdrop anyway, could you just initially generally take us through what your involvement was with Lehman sort of post Bear Stearns and what the thinking was within
right.
the government about providing or not providing assistance?
Let me make a quick disclosure that any confidential information shared here is covered by our non-disclosure agreement.
Go ahead. Sure. Yeah.
So I'll confess I'm not one with a great memory of things that happened 2 years ago. A lot of things happened between then and now. I mainly have gone through your emails and was pleased that largely, at least what was in the emails, is more or less consistent with what I recollect. I think that, you know, as you know, we got through the Bear failure, through the Fed's assistance to J.P. Morgan that allowed it to feel comfortable going forward with the purchase of Bear Stearns. In an immediate aftermath, we introduced the primary dealer credit facility to help stabilize the tri-party market. And then, and as you noted, we then began, while the SEC remained the regulator of Lehman and Bear Stearns and the other investment banks, we had a limited on-site supervisory presence that provided us with information as to the risk profiles of those firms. And my recollection is for several months, things looked better. CDS spreads narrowed, kind of looked like we dodged the bullet, although I don't think anyone was ever fully confident of that. But then things began to head in an adverse direction again. It looked to me, just judging from the emails, that a key thing was when in mid-July, Moody's downgraded Lehman Brothers' short-term debt to A2. That seems to have put us to, again, I don't remember all these details, that put us on a higher level of alert. I always thought, others might have differed, that the main justification in my own mind for intervening to provide assistance to facilitate the acquisition of Bear by Morgan was to avoid the potential shock to the tri-party market. I think that's clear in the emails that was my view. And we were aware that there still was a danger that, in fact, there's a long email I sent to the governors after an FOMC meeting where evidently Geithner gave a very brief answer as to what our options were and what we were thinking about. Mm-hmm. And I elaborated and I explained why, notwithstanding the existence of the PDCF, you still might have its clearing bank, which was J.P. Morgan Chase, reluctant to unwind the repos one morning, and the Trina horribles, at least I saw following from that, that morning those investors would wake up not with $200 billion of cash in their account, which they expected rightly or wrongly. I may not have understood their legal agreements with Chase, which did not require Chase to do that, but instead to find $200 billion of securities, including you have money market mutual funds holding securities they're not actually authorized to hold. And if they had to sell them in a fire sale, almost surely, even though the collateral, some of it was quite liquid, well, there are always limits to liquidity. If you try to liquidate $75 billion of Ginnie Mae securities, you may have a problem, even though they're pretty liquid securities. Mm-hmm. Those investors probably would incur losses, and again, the fear would be they'd pull back from the other dealers, and we'd basically have a meltdown of the funding structure of Wall Street. And clearly, it was interesting, the Moody's ratings downgrade indicated they were beginning to have doubts fundamentally about the funding model on Wall Street. Well, I think we were already there into realizing its fragility. So there were two problems with the existing PDCF, one of which was soluble and we did solve. I'm not quite sure how the other one was resolved. You didn't have the any of the SIPC emails, and I'm not real clear about it. I know I went to some meetings at SIPC. What happened out of all that, I don't know. But two issues were the PDCF only covered immediately post-bear open market operation eligible collateral, so it did not cover the equities, the non-investment grade debt, maybe some other cats and dogs, which Lehman was financing. So, if the way that the PDCF should have given confidence to the clearing bank and to the repo investors was that we were essentially the repo investor of last resort. So for the OMO collateral, not to worry. Even if you choose one day not to roll your financing, we'll come in there and finance it. So you're going to get out. You're going to get mm-hmm. your cash. But not so for the non-OMO collateral. You could wonder, okay, we clearly our program didn't cover that. What happens if you decide you want your money back and nobody else decides to finance that collateral? You might get stuck. And the other thing, the SIPC issue, was the fear, even though we would come in at the end of the day as the repo investor of last resort, if there were an intraday bankruptcy, fear that you'd never get there. And the clearing bank, the music would stop in the middle of the day when the clearing bank had the collateral and we had not yet put in the cash to finance that collateral. And I do recall, and this is actually, if no one is focused on this, one of the problems was SIPC at least viewed the only time they could go to a court and initiate a SIPC proceeding was during the business day in New York. So while any regulator or central bank anywhere in the world would say you want to close a bank at the end of the day, closing it in the middle of the day is insanity. In fact, SIPC said, well, sorry, that's the only time we can close it. And I don't remember how we eventually got J.P. Morgan Chase calmed down about that. And as you probably, as I don't know the intimate details, but as the Lehman broker-dealer was gradually wound down, this was a constant friction and a constant fear, not only on the part of J.P. Morgan Chase, but TTC, the Depository Trust Company, which is also a sort of an intraday creditor that wasn't mm-hmm. intending to be an overnight creditor. But on the OMO, the non-OML eligible collateral, in the end, our contingency plan didn't involve some of these complex Goldberg schemes that some of the New York Fed were dreaming of, but simply saying we would finance the non-OML collateral. And that was enough, as it turned out, to get J.P. Morgan to agree to unwind the repo. And so to avoid, that was our contingency plan, in effect, even though we considered a million different contingencies. And also, you may have seen the email where I just said, because I don't think J.P. Morgan acted heroically throughout this crisis, you ought to just tell those sons of bitches they're going to unwind that collateral. If they don't, they're never going to do business in this town again. Plain and simple. I don't think anyone ever quite. I don't know what message at the midnight hour that night was delivered, but and they were threatening not only not to unwind Lehman's collateral, but not to unwind any of the tri-party collateral. But in the end, they relented. And I don't know who talked to whom in the senior management of J.P. Morgan that night, but. But eventually that problem was addressed.
When you say that night?
It was Sunday night.
The weekend.
Right. I couldn't tell you whether it was actually Saturday or Sunday. Because I attended meetings, Fed staff, and I met with senior officials at J.P. Morgan. My impression is whatever was worked out ultimately was that at one level higher, which I was not involved in. We certainly reported to Tim and to others that they were making threats that we weren't very happy with, and how he responded to that information, you'll have to look at other emails that I wasn't on. You know, you go back to, I thought the key document on all the ones was my August 4th game plan. Actually, again, I don't remember clearly the genesis of this, but somebody, actually, game plan sounds like Paulson speak, but possibly Guyton speak. So somebody must have asked us for a game plan for what, and I guess the game plan was for
August 4th or August 8th?
I'm sorry. Maybe it's August 8th. It's August 8th. I stand corrected.
The one through 5.
Yeah. And I think, again, I never know whether my thinking is identical to others' thinking, but this certainly was what I understood the assignment to be. And if you go down to, I guess, point 4, our preliminary view was that the main riskiest things were the tripartite borrowings we've already discussed and OTC derivatives activities. And then we had questions about others, but frankly didn't have as much information. One other thing about tripartite is because it's all facilitated by the clearing banks, and we supervised the clearing banks, we had lots and lots of information about tripartite. Mm-hmm. Significant deficit, as you could see from the emails, we didn't know much about their OTC derivatives activities.
Right.
One of the other interesting things I thought came through the chain of emails that I hadn't fully remembered was how many times we were reluctant to collect information or take action for fear of essentially triggering the thing we were worried about, which was a Lehman failure. So I know it's not really in here, but we had discussions over the summer. I think in June or July, our chairman had given a speech or a testimony or whatever it was saying we needed this new resolution authority. We realized we didn't have the resolution authority. Absent the resolution authority, our options were not very good. Question was, should we go to Congress and say we need it and we need it now? Well, I think the reaction was one, they would say, why do you need it? And if we said, because we think Lehman is on the ropes, then Lehman would go from off the ropes to on the floor. And there was no guarantee they'd give it to us, which I think subsequently developments indicated how reluctant they would be. Or even the emails reflecting this information request with respect to OTC derivatives activities and the fact that it sounded like we bandied about and I was working with Art Angelo to come up with an information request. It sounded like independently, not that this happens frequently within the Federal Reserve, the New York Fed acted sort of on its own without letting me know and went in and talked to Lehman about their derivatives activities. And even that sort of gentle, oblique approach caused a lot of consternation at Lehman because they rightly inferred from the questions we were asking that we were beginning to ask if Lehman went into bankruptcy, what would happen? And I could imagine they may have thought that unthinkable, and the fact that we were thinking it caused some alarm. But in the end, I think Guyton decided that we would not go forward with that particular information request. And then, as I at least followed the email chain, as I remember this, at some point they decide, and I was pushing getting Jerry Corrigan involved. His Goldman Association wasn't quite so toxic yet in the summer of 2008, and he had led a variety of industry efforts to improve the infrastructure of the OTC derivatives markets, was extremely knowledgeable and supportive of central bank efforts to do so. And their own industry report had talked about creating this default management group, but like so many industry recommendations, that one was never acted on. And again, you saw my notion of calling up Corrigan and trying even to camouflage it, to say, well, you know, this really isn't about Lehman. This is about just following up. We noticed it was a recommendation in your report. It hasn't been done. We think you should move forward. Even that was regarded as too risky, so it wasn't done. So they turned to an existing group, and this was only, if you look at the emails, it's now days before Lehman's failure, and they decided to go to the the OMG, the Operations Management Group, which essentially was an advisory group the New York Fed had set up to support their efforts to improve the OTC derivatives infrastructure, with Theo Lubke being sort of the key staff member there. And they did activate that group, and it did meet over the weekend. I don't recall that I attended any of those meetings. I think what happened was that, you know, there are many things. One thing to be said, having, I think, was one of only two people from the board that was actually at the New York Fed that weekend. Not as if you're there, but there are many things going on. And they're going on at the same time. So very few people, I couldn't claim to know everything was going on. I indeed, when it came to, you've got meetings on OTC derivatives going on in one room, and you've got meetings in tri-party repo going on in, a room, in another room. You can't be in both rooms. And it was probably my judgment that the tri-party thing was much more dangerous than the OTC derivatives thing. But whether it was for that reason or some other reason, for the most part, I think I focused on the tri-party, although I do remember quizzing in the late hours of one of those nights some guy from Lehman that ran their interest rate options trading desk, because I was a little worried about that specific business line where they were the leading dealer in U.S. dollar interest rate options, and oh, by the way, the biggest purchasers are Fannie and Freddie for hedging their MBS portfolios. I never, don't know to this day how that got worked out, how Fannie and Freddie were able to replace those contracts, but I guess they did, since I haven't heard the contrary. But for the most part, I focused on tri-party and other points. So the conclusion, whatever it was, of the derivatives contingency planning story involved Lubke and the OMG and not so much me. I think I popped my head in and out of their war room periodically, but was not involved in any continuous way, and don't remember meeting with the industry people. But I do remember the meetings with J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of New York and some of the tension there, and as I say, reported the concerns and the attitudes up the chain, and somehow or another, we got to where we needed to be, which was that they agreed to unwind after we agreed to extend the PDCF to cover the full range of collateral being financed at tri-party. And exactly how that happened, who said what to whom, whether anybody finally did tell them, as I suggested, that, you know, I think I said it would be unforgivable to not unwind tri-party. Whether anyone used that terminology, I don't know. So, step back from this, what do I take away? I mean, we didn't have complete information by any means on Lehman's activities, but quite frankly, even if we had been the supervisor, you're still trying to gauge what are the channels of systemic contagion. It's not like that's sort of a look it up in a table sort of exercise. You're coming to judgments. We came to the judgment that the tri-party and the OTC derivatives were the two most important potential channels of contagion. We had a well-developed contingency. We had too many contingency plans for tri-party. We actually did one of them. With respect to OTC derivatives, would have been my judgment that let it happen, teach them a good lesson, won't be the end of the world. I think pretty much that's what happened. I'm not sure if it taught them a lesson, but it wasn't the end of the world. And what's instructive about all this is having chased all these things down and made our judgments about what the channels were and developed contingency plans for mitigating those threats or concluding that they weren't as severe as we feared. We didn't quite clearly know anything or never thought to ask, would a single money market mutual fund have 3% of their assets in Lehman Brothers commercial paper? I think if which was the worst event, worst consequence of Lehman's default, because it then led to a massive run on the money fund industry, which really froze the money markets and spreads going through the ceiling, and required us to develop a bunch of liquidity facilities to gradually get those markets back limping along. But we didn't foresee that, and so our actions to contain it were only initiated after the sort of worst of it had happened. And I think beyond that, we underestimated, I think, I underestimated, I won't use we, the ex- extent to which the doctrine of too big to fail was so strongly ingrained, perhaps, if anything, strengthened by our action with respect to Bear, and therefore how severe the shock was to financial market participants when we didn't deliver on too big to fail, right? So I guess a certain amount of humility about all these analyses and these contingency plans is what I take away from that. Also, this whole issue throughout the crisis, whether it was here, this concern about signaling or the way our traditional central bank liquidity facilities didn't work because of fears of stigma, which is essentially their fears of signaling, another sort of difficulty that policymakers face, sort of a generic, general quality to it, when trying to stabilize things.
During the weekend, when you're involved in discussions with JPMC and Boney, and you mentioned that JP Morgan, those SOBs, were threatening not to unwind transactions.
They're threatening. They said, we're not comfortable doing it. We're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know.
Was Boney saying the same thing?
I don't think so. Well, number one, it's academic because Lehman wasn't their client. But
right.
I think if you talk to people on Wall Street that were phony clients, because after all, eventually Goldman and Morgan Stanley fell under the cloud, and they were Bank of New York clients.
Right.
Again, I don't work for those firms, but my perception is that they felt that Boney was more committed to this business and less prone to pull the trigger than JPMC.
Mm-hmm. And who were you talking to at JP Morgan Chase that was saying they weren't going to unwind on Monday the 15th?
I think it was a chief risk officer.
Zubrow.
And maybe David Weisbrod. And they've had so many changes there over the years that the business people, it could have been Jane Byers Russo. Who I think is now not in that position at JP anymore, but I don't know for sure.
What about Mr. Diamond or Black? Were they in those discussions?
I don't think I've ever met Mr. Black. Okay. I met Mr. Diamond. He was in the building that weekend,
right,
on the executive floor, but he was not at the meetings I was at. This is the thing. He's going to meet with Tim or Kevin Warsh or Hank. Mm-hmm. I don't meet with Jamie Dimon. I meet with his immediate subordinates, but not with him. Oh, and Heidi Miller. Let's not forget Heidi Miller.
So those four are the ones that you were meeting with?
That's who I remember okay. We were meeting with, yeah.
Okay. And just why? I mean, I think I know why, but why were they saying they were not going to unwind on Monday?
Well, I assumed that they were demonstrating to us the depth of their concern about the risk to which they would be exposed if they unwound, and they were, would have been, and they wanted us to expand the PDCF to make them feel comfortable doing it, and they succeeded in that end.
And so, again, that you anticipated my next question. The way that their fears or concerns were alleviated was by the Fed agreeing to finance non-OMO collateral.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, in the circumstances we were in, it was pretty important that those repos be unwound. Arguably, the PDCF was not one of our high-risk liquidity facilities, in my own humble estimation. You know, it's even equities. Equities are pretty good collateral. Some would say equities are better collateral than these lousy corporate bonds, which are liquid as hell. You just charge a big enough haircut, and everything is cool. And I think that was the main chunk of non-OMO. You got the numbers, but the main chunk of non-OMO collateral that we financed was equities.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen in the documents, and I don't know if they were the same ones I identified for you, Dave. But in one document, I saw an estimate that for like August 8th, the total tri-party repo market was like $2.3 trillion, and about $200 billion of that was non-PDCF eligible. I don't know if there's.
I'm surprised it wasn't. It may have been. I know it reached a peak of $2.75 trillion, but that might have been earlier.
This is just
summer.
One particular day.
Yeah.
I mean, so it wasn't any kind of average.
Yeah.
And then I've also seen estimates that, you know, while Lehman was.
Well, not estimates. That's the thing to remember.
Right.
It's a great thing about tri-party. It's the two banks. We've got data from both banks, so they're not estimates. It's not a sample. It's
right. It's the actual.
Yes.
And then there was also. Documents that indicated that, you know, Lehman was ballpark a $200 billion tri-party repo shop with about 10% of that or $20 billion being non-PDCF eligible. Is that generally consistent with your recollection?
Yeah, you're consistent generally my recollections, but you got the numbers, and if you don't have the numbers, I assume they're... I can't believe in all those emails there weren't attachments that showed all the tri-party activity.
There's often reference to attachments that aren't there.
I see.
So that's sometimes the issue we have. And not to mention just time of looking at everything. But I appreciate that. Thank you. Now, help me understand then. Because, again, the main thing, I've heard what you said about we didn't deliver on too big to fail and folks didn't appreciate... how much that was ingrained in. But we do see, you know, throughout the time period leading right up into that weekend, you know, that there is concern and recognition about the systemic consequences of Lehman going down without an orderly wind down, at least. And sure, to the private consortium, there's not going to be one penny, there's not going to be assistance, although the documents indicate that, well, there might be, you know, if things, you know, we'll see how things go over the weekend. And that's the one thing that at least I and I think Art and some of my colleagues have been struggling with, is understanding completely why, given those given that recognition and the concerns that there would be systemic consequences and consideration of various ways to do it, why it wasn't done.
Sure. Well, now you're going to ask a question I can't answer, but let's say, what was our assessment? I think we were too optimistic. We underestimated, I underestimated the degree of disruption that would be caused by a Lehman bankruptcy. And again, that was because we looked at what we knew of their businesses. We identified what we thought were the two principal potential sources of contagion. We had a contingency plan for one, which was our gravest concern, which is tri-party, which worked. So there was no contagion through the tri-party channel. I, at least, was not as worried as some others about the OTC derivatives channel. And while I think the OMG group mitigated the risk to some extent, the bottom line was that the Lehman legal entities that were the counterparties to the derivatives failed, and their counterparties closed out the positions and liquidated the collateral and away you went. And I didn't think that would be a complete debacle, and in fact, it wasn't a complete debacle, although it may have played into, you know, for example, I think after Bear, after Lehman, the derivatives, particularly the prime brokerage clients of the investment banks, realized the channels through which they would be at risk if, say, a Goldman or a Morgan Stanley or a Merrill Lynch went down, and that probably contributed to further liquidity. Because even if in the end, and we also learned the other thing I don't think anybody appreciated, was how the bankruptcy of Lehman's, that number one, the failure of Lehman's parent would trigger immediately an insolvency proceeding in London. At least I didn't understand that. Because we were used to, like in the U.S., we had, whether it was Drexel or whether it was, who was that other one, Refco, where the parent fails, broker-dealer and FCM subsidiaries sail along until we've, you know, unwound them in an orderly way. And who cares if the parent failed? Well, I think we knew that was a little bit naive in the case of Lehman. It had many more non-broker-dealer, non-FCM subs that were important. But we didn't understand how screwed up the bankruptcy laws were in the UK, where they still haven't sorted things out to this day. much as I was suggesting earlier, there's some aspects of our broker-dealer insolvency regime that need careful review and amendment. Gee, ours is a thing of beauty compared to what the hell they do in the UK, where they freeze everything indefinitely. They have what are they called, liquidators or whoever they are. They're subject to unlimited personal liability, and you got to ask yourself, gee, they tell you you're going to wind this thing down, and you're subject to unlimited personal liability. How quickly are you going to act to make decisions? I think you're going to be very, very slow and cautious with unlimited personal liability, and that has proven to be the case.
So the contingency plans for dealing with the two major concerns in terms of systemic fallout was, for the tri-party repo, was expanding the collateral that the PDCF would finance,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And then for the OTC derivatives, the contingency plan was this netting exercise that went on Sunday afternoon. Is that accurate?
I think that's right. You got to talk to somebody else about the netting.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's an area that I've been having trouble figuring out.
Talk to Theo. Okay. It's pretty clear who's in charge.
All right. understanding that Mr. Lubke can give me better information on that,
yeah.
Dave. It'll be a quick conversation. One of the things, if you don't know, just tell me, who's involved in that exercise? Because it looks like perhaps some major U.S. derivative counterparties are involved, but a bunch of others are not.
I think it was pretty. One of the virtues of the. Oh, there's a list in here somewhere. Was how broad it was. That it included not only dealers but some hedge funds and asset managers. And again, to give some credit to Theo and to Tim Geithner and others, the fact that the wind down of the, not the wind down, the termination and replacement of the Lehman contracts wasn't a complete god-awful mess, was only because of the improvements in the market infrastructure and the changes in practices, I would submit, that the industry accomplished under intense pressure from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. A lot of pages. Here we go. Here's what I'm looking for. Here's the OMG.
What date are you on?
I don't know what it is. I have a hard time figuring these emails out.
No.
Where they actually begin and end.
Got to find that original message that starts it.
But you can have this back if you want.
Okay.
Because it has some of my editorial comments on it. But the
even better.
But there's the list, and it's in addition to all the major U.S. dealers: Barclays, BNP Paribas, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, and even buy-side firms: AllianceBernstein, Blue Mountain, who's a huge credit derivatives player; Citadel Investment, and I don't see any hedge. Well, actually, Blue Mountain's a hedge fund. I think AllianceBernstein is more of a traditional asset manager, and Citadel, of course, is a hedge fund. And you had the industry associations, including the Managed Funds Association, which and the asset management group of SIFMA, which represents the traditional, the non-hedge funds, traditional asset managers.
Right.
So that was one of the virtues of using this group rather than, although I think Corrigan's thing had some tentacles reaching into the buy side as well. They had this thing up and going. I think the other reason they may have gone this direction is, number one, it already existed. It could be activated without maybe quite so many alarm bells going off. It included the actual guys that run the businesses rather than Corrigan and guys like that who were, I think Corrigan's group was primarily senior risk managers in the firm who may or may not know all the details of the operations of a derivatives business. But these guys on this OMG actually knew more than anybody in the world about how the nuts and bolts of things really worked.
Mm-hmm. So when the Barclays deal falls apart on Sunday, it's our understanding that before that deal fell apart, there had been a deal worked out with the private consortium to ring fence out the ballpark, $50 billion of assets that no one wanted.
Yes. I mean, I think I went to only one of those meetings with the Poobahs. And it was in the middle of the thing. It was not the beginning. It was not the end. But it was my impression, yes, that sort of the notion was the government didn't want to be providing assistance, but we tried to facilitate an arrangement where basically the private sector would create a Maybelline type vehicle,
right,
where they protected the acquirer from the losses on a fixed pool of assets. And my impression as to what happened over the weekend was the further the firms were in Lehman proceeded with their due diligence, the more crappy assets they found, and the bigger the pool of assets that the potential acquirer wanted protection on became. And I think that was partly I shouldn't conjecture. Also, I suspect one of the two buyers, potential buyers, which was Bank of America, having succeeded in buying Merrill Lynch, thought to this, what the hell do I want to do buying Lehman Brothers? I got a better deal, a better franchise. And Barclays, I don't know what went on there. I've read Paulson's account and I've read the Wessel's account, but again, that was I was not involved in conversations with the UK authorities to know how much that played into it. So I don't know the answer. I mean, some say it's in the end they had a deal with the UK authorities, put the kibosh on it. I think it's equally likely that the deeper Barclays got into it, the more they decided this is just too big a mess for us to take on. And gee, look at what's happened to Barclays subsequently. They've been out of their minds to take a huge chunk of risk. But what they did was much smarter. They waited for it to go into receivership and then bought the broker-dealer, which was probably the crown jewel anyway. Mm-hmm. So I suppose they look pretty smart. I wasn't in those meetings. And most of what I know, I suspect, is from reading these books, not from not anything you'd want to cite in your report.
Right. But and understanding that, but once that deal goes down, were you involved in it, once the Barclays deal falls apart, were you involved in any discussions, or do you have any understanding of why at that point the government didn't say, well, let's provide some financing to Lehman since we still have the private consortium deal to provide a more orderly wind down as opposed to this company filing for bankruptcy the next day?
Well, I'm not sure we have the. I don't think if you don't have a buyer, one of the things that allowed us to get through Bear's failure was when JP bought Bear with our assistance, they assumed all the liabilities of Bear, and that meant anybody who was a counterparty in any financial transaction with Bear said, oh, I've now got J.P. Morgan as my counterparty. I'm no more panicking. Whereas without an acquirer, you don't really have an end game. I mean, all right, you finance certain securities to avoid the disorderly wind down. Still, there were going to be very significant losses to Lehman. So still, you would have reserve fund holding this commercial paper that's not worth anywhere near par. I don't know how that would have achieved in a material way. And again, the collateral we would have been most willing to finance was the collateral that was in the tri-party pool. And we'd already offered to finance that. It just wasn't necessarily on anything near the same scale, because once you have the great thing about a backup liquidity facility is it encourages primary creditors to continue to provide credit and obviates draws on the facility itself.
Do you recall any discussions about it, though? About, you know,
no.
All right, look, Barclays is done. At least we have a deal to ring fence out the assets. Instead of having these guys file and having the PDCF and
again,
having the
OT. I don't see how ring fencing out those assets obviates a filing.
Well, I understand ring fencing the assets alone doesn't obviate a filing, but wouldn't that, combined with the Fed providing a financing under 13.3 for, basically buying time for a more orderly wind down as opposed to the holy
so
crap, what happens
when... So, we would have financed a bunch of assets, but I still think if I'm somebody who's a creditor of them, I'm not certain what that does for me exactly. You're not guaranteeing repayment of my liability.
Doesn't it allow time to simply find another counterparty?
Where was that counterparty going to come from? I mean, they'd already... Who was going to buy? I mean, particularly, you'd had two big firms go in and do due diligence and decide they wanted no part of this. Right.
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, you know, we've been talking to, you know, several entities, hedge funds and other, that had prime brokerage accounts at Lehman, and some of their beefs are, you know, if the government just would have let these guys stay open for another week or two, you know, that would have given us time to move our positions to accounts and other investment banks, and instead we're tied up in these U.S. and U.K. bankruptcy proceedings trying to get our cash and securities out. So, I mean, was there any thinking along those lines and how that would, you know, reduce some of the systemic consequences?
Not to my knowledge. Again, I don't think with respect to that freezing of assets in the U.K., that at least that was not well understood by me. Now, it's true that one of the difficulties we had as a government, I don't think the SEC knew anything about procedures outside the United States. We didn't really know much about it. My recollection is we hired half the lawyers at Cleary Gottlieb to explain to us how that would work. But you know, you'd have to go digging through a million emails to see whether even they fully understood how the parent filing in the U.S. would interact, and then it's not only that there would be whatever they call it, administrator, whatever they call it.
I think administrator is right.
Appointed, but the administrator has unlimited liability, and therefore he'd freeze everything till hell froze over. I don't know that they understood that. My recollection is, you know, you stay up that late that night and stumbled over to some hotel room, came back in the next day, spent maybe that day yet at the New York Fed, whether that was the Monday. Not terribly clear during the course of that day that I'm at that point adding value, and then I came back. And frankly, I think one of the things that was going on by Monday, and even over the weekend, AIG was rearing its ugly head. And one of the great things about having been involved in and sort of committed to working on contingency plans for Lehman and being up at the New York Fed that weekend was that I was therefore not involved in AIG and have never been involved in AIG. So in the millions of congressional inquiries about AIG, I never get called because my name doesn't appear in any of those emails.
Did you know?
And that worked out pretty well for me, I think.
I mean, and we've actually seen it in the documents. We see, you know, in mid-August 2008, at least AIG certainly come, at least by that time, no later than that time, AIG gets on the Fed's radar, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's radar, in terms of liquidity concerns, not surprising, since they've been paying billions of dollars collateral calls for the entire year. And subsequently, there's additional analyses we see in emails saying it's not looking good. And of course,
Are out of the New York Fed.
Right. And of course, Friday night, AIG knocks on the door and says we're going to have the ratings downgrade, understanding that you weren't involved in AIG.
Right.
Do you recall hearing anything on that weekend or subsequent that, you know, the fact that AIG came knocking on the door and might need assistance was part of the analysis of whether or not to provide assistance to Lehman?
Well, again, I knew that AIG was in there. I know that they were talking. I knew they were troubled, that they were looking for some kind of assistance, and that, again, outside. But at one point, I think there was considerable optimism on some. That it was all going to work out well. The consortium was going to get through Lehman. Bank of America was going to buy Merrill, and somebody was going to buy AIG, whether that was Flowers or whoever the hell it was that was in there.
Yeah, Flowers and Alliance is at least the rumor, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and again, I was not close to any of these things in this hallway conversation. I do recall, and I don't know whether this was an ex post justification of what was being discussed at the time, that I think it's probably the former, actually, but that you know, we were very worried with Bear. Why did we stay at Bear? I don't really subscribe to this, but one theory is because we knew if Bear went down that Lehman was really weak and they were going to go down in the immediate aftermath. Whereas we thought if Lehman went down, the two we were most worried about were AIG and Merrill. And at least at some point over the weekend, it looked like we had contingency plans for that. And in one of two cases, we did. But you're talking to the wrong person about these things, because I was not. Again, the ultimate decision as to why we did or didn't assist Lehman, I wasn't in the room on that decision. And you need to talk to the people who made the decision. To the extent I had a role, it may have been saying, well, two principal concerns are Tri-Party and OTC. We've got a contingency plan for Tri-Party. Don't see OTC. Is that a big deal? So, you know, I wouldn't be as worried as if I hadn't gone down those paths and reached those conclusions. I already explained why they were misinformed in some sense. But I don't know the answer to your question.
Sure. And understanding, ultimately, they weren't your decisions, and I know whose decisions, at least I think I know whose decisions they were. What about also another thing we've seen in the documents anyway are you know, not surprisingly, references to, hey, you know, we have not been getting, you know, a bunch of warm fuzzies from providing assistance for Bear in March of 08, and a week ago we just put the GSEs into conservatorship. That's going to cost the government more than a few dollars. Mm-hmm. Were there discussions simply about the political realities of doing this?
I was not party to those discussions. I would be shocked if there weren't those discussions, but I wasn't party to them.
Same people, I take it, we should talk to about that.
Talk to Tim and Hank and.
Okay. With the benefit of 2 years, I mean, looking back, do you think Lehman was too big to fail and that the government should have done something in terms of providing financing to provide some kind of more orderly wind down, even though there was, at Sunday at least, not an acquirer since Barclays had dropped out?
I think that's the tough thing without the acquirer. When you say we should have done something, what is the something?
And I guess the something would be 13-3 financing.
Okay. Right. And the question would be, without a buyer, how would... It's not obvious to me that providing 13-3 financing, and I assume we would not have wanted to do that for the crappiest kinds of collateral, that providing 13-3 financing, then what would have been? I mean, basically their best assets were in Tri-Party, and we were already willing to provide financing for those. Maybe we could have gone beyond that to fund a broader range of equities without taking undue risk. But the further you go out there, you know, the more risk the Fed would be taking on for uncertain benefit, it seems to me. And to be honest, without a full appreciation of just how disruptive the bankruptcy was actually going to turn out to be.
Could I ask a follow-up on that? Because one, you had the consortium at least, you know, prepared apparently to ring fence off the
right.
A lot of the worst of the real estate assets. You'd made a determination, I guess, jointly with the SEC, that you were going to save the broker-dealer and at least allow for an orderly wind-down if someone like Barclays didn't come along to buy it. Do you have any sense of the magnitude of what was left once you know, and what that would have involved if you got the broker-dealer over here and the ring-fenced real estate over there?
I don't have a clear. I do remember over the summer months, and it was a source of frustration, the limited amount of information we had about the global operations of Lehman, but we did have some information, which I believe the SEC was the source. But it was always maddeningly
vague,
incomplete, and confusing. And you know, whether somebody, presumably at the SEC or maybe at the Fed, was studying that information over the weekend, I just don't know. That wasn't me in any event. Mm-hmm.
And I guess another question would be, with the was the expansion of the PDCF, in a sense, enough to keep the broker-dealer going, or did the Fed have to take other actions in order to keep the broker-dealer basically in operation during that following week? If you recall, you may not know.
I think PDCF was quite important. Right. I think beyond that, what I remember, again, you're not really talking to the right person, but our lawyers in Cleary working for us, because they were our lawyers, they came over the wall, and they were working for us, did an incredible amount of what I would call hand-holding, especially with J.P. Morgan and with DTC. DTC has the right at any moment, sort of like J.P. Morgan, to refusing to unwind. DTC can decide to cease to act, is the term they use for a member. And they're out of business when they cease to act. But DTC was running risks in acting, essentially, as the intermediary, taking delivery of securities, delivering out securities for Lehman Brothers. And I know there was a lot of hand-holding with DTC to get them to hang in there. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that was a case where DTC did hang in there, and as always, in a crisis, you'd like to convince people not to look simply at their own
self-interest,
but to look at the broader interest, and I think they did some of that, although maybe that's easier for them as an industry utility, who a disorderly wind, they're owned by the street, basically, and disorderly wind down of Lehman triggered by their refusal to act would not be good for their members. But mm-hmm. even so, I think they were very nervous, and some of our folks were doing some handholding there. I don't know what other handholding they might have been doing, but I know there was some working with Civic. Civic was another very nervous.
Right.
But that at that point, when it got to SIPC's claims on the collateral versus DTC's versus J.P. Morgan's and how to hand all this off during the day and whatnot. Again, I know Cleary was involved. I know some of our lawyers were involved, our being the Fed, the New York Fed, more so than board. I don't have a clear recollection. In fact, you know, I don't never get my timing right, but when I got back here, you might ask, well, what was I doing? Did I take a vacation or something? As soon as I got back, we had the run of the money fund industry, and I spent the next several months designing liquidity facilities, starting with the AMLF and then with the CPFF and MMIFF and TALF and all those damn things. It sort of had moved on to, again,
a new front in the war, essentially.
Yeah.
One question also is, I think you say you came back on the Monday, at which point, obviously, the news...
Maybe a Tuesday. Someone has my travel records, I'm sure. I'm not sure. I think I stayed one more day and then kind of said, you know, there were reasons for me to be back here, and it wasn't clear any longer what productive role I was playing up there.
Do you recall whether it was Tuesday or another day when you became kind of aware that, wait a minute, things are kind of starting to spin out of control? In other words, my sense is, from what I've read, which is, as you say, impressionistic, that Monday, not a lot happened, but somehow Tuesday things seemed to be getting worse. And is that consistent with your recollection? Or
it's consistent with my recollection, but again, I think I would look at CDS spreads and that sort of thing. I think there's even this John Taylor theory of the world that none of this would have happened if we hadn't gone running to the hill and saying
right.
terrible things were going to happen. And I have no views on whether, I'm not a macroeconomist,
right.
I'm not a
right.
financial markets guy, but I know that there was sort of a delayed reaction, and others have interpreted that in a way of suggesting that it really
wasn't a problem, right? Right.
Right.
If you can go back a minute to the summer, because we've seen these documents in July, as you say, I hadn't seen it was Moody's that did it, but there was news that Dreyfus and Federighi were pulling money out of Lehman, and there seemed to be a lot of concern that you might be faced with Lehman weekend in July, and we see sort of different scenarios being thought about. I mean, one was sort of a Maiden Lane type approach that Mr. Dudley suggested up in New York. Can you share with us sort of what your response was?
My recollection was that. I think I had my response in one of these emails. It was not...
His email was July 15th, if it
right.
helps.
Your response didn't seem overly friendly, but I... I don't want to characterize your response.
Didn't seem overly friendly. Well, I think the words probably should speak for themselves. Like I find it... This is my response. I said, I think this option is much too complex. To answer a question others have asked, the biggest difference between today when Bear lost access to financing is that the PDCF is in place. As long as we judge that LB is sound, we should be willing to lend to it through the PDCF with conservative haircuts, as previously envisioned. With the PDCF in place, there is no need to use JPMC as an intermediary and being indemnifying them against loss. But and I went on to say we should tell JPMC that the PDCF in place, refusing to unwind, is unnecessary and would be unforgivable. I kind of like those words. Right. I've forgotten about those. Right. But
I read Mr. Dudley's piece, maybe I've misinterpreted it, as kind of going beyond the tri-party repos and sort of looking at how do we keep Lehman sort of a viable entity, perhaps long enough for it to be sold to somebody else. That he seemed to be looking at more than just sort of a freeze up of the tri-party repo market, but sort of sense that they might be faced with collapse the way Bear was, and what if you didn't have a counterparty acquired
right.
immediately available?
Well, I'm not going to be able to find that email, but I thought at one point. I had a concern that to the extent we were basically absorbing more and more of the risk of their tri-party financing, that'll make the clearing bank happy and it'll make the tri-party investors happy, but why would it make any other creditors of Lehman happy? So that didn't strike me. It struck me I won't be able to find the email, but I thought somewhere in there was some email where I was making that point, that here you want to design this extremely complicated loss-sharing guarantee mechanism for tri-party. And in my view, that had all kinds of issues associated with it and would not stabilize all their other funding.
This is one of the email chains going back, I think, between you and Mr. Fallon and Mr. Alvarez.
Well, I haven't seen this one.
It was more addressed to you than really reflecting your own statements.
Yeah. See scenario that New York is shopping. There's a certain tone to it for dealing with Lehman. Difference between proposal and Bear. No buyer in the wings for Lehman. We've discussed that
right,
already.
Right.
Lehman would get $5 billion in equity and LLC form to take bad assets. Fed would get equity in the good Lehman.
There's sort of a good Lehman, bad Lehman approach, which is in a way, you know, reminiscent of Main Lane.
And well, I didn't, for whatever reason, I didn't see these emails, and it would take me a while.
Okay, I mean, it's not something that rings a strong bell with you. The so-called Dudley plan, I guess you might call it, which, as I say, seems to go a step beyond simply taking care of the tri-party repos, and seems to say, how do we keep this institution alive, maybe long enough to find a buyer? We don't have one right now. Those emails are kind of scattered, so I think that they may not follow in a chain completely.
But generally, that's what when we go chronologically through the documents, you know, throughout we see the concern about the tri-party repo market.
Sure.
We see Dudley's proposal about the ring fence, and then later on we see the, you know, we also got to get information on the OTC derivatives, but we don't want to spook folks about asking for it.
Well, see, on OTC derivatives, because on the other hand, with tri-party, we already had all of it. So,
right.
I don't. I'll confess.
And then it sort of blended into
this
the whole
particular
20,
document.
23A.
I have no recollection of that. Doesn't mean I didn't read it at the time, but I don't recollect it.
That's to some extent blends into the notion of would they be turned into a bank holding company, would they do a 23A push down, you know, from the Lehman parent into their ILC, which involved the FDIC?
Right. Now, that's legal division territory, and
right.
and as you know, they're becoming a bank holding company. Presumably, they would do that to get access to funding from the discount window and or insured deposits. And the problem is that in each case, that funding would be provided through the discount window or through FDIC insurance only to the DI entity.
Right.
And then for them, for that to be of much benefit in terms of financing their existing assets, we would have to agree to allow the DI to purchase large amounts
right,
of assets.
Right, the 23A type.
Right, and notwithstanding 23A. And
but were you not, it sounds like you weren't really directly involved with that sort of bank holding company 23A.
Oh, no, that's, you know, part of the things, too, is to understand the way this place works. You know, the board turns to certain people for certain issues and others for other issues. And 23A and B, I was probably aware of these things and maybe went to meetings or whatever, but that is, would have been legal division territory, and then also I see Deborah Bailey. It would have been the division I'm not
supervision.
On. Right. But I was not in the supervision division at the time. So I was aware of these discussions, but was not smack dab in the middle of them. I don't know how, like even this email chain, you know, Pat said that Cohn did not push back very hard on this proposal on call last night. I don't remember what I was doing at that right. call or why. Again, at this point, without a longer string of emails to refresh my memory, I don't know what this is about.
Right. And thinking back to July, obviously Merrill was of great concern at that point. They seemed to be almost as weak as Lehman. Do you think that part of your thinking about Lehman in July and August, or maybe early August, reflected the fact that you were concerned that, you know, Merrill was the next domino and you didn't have, you know, a clear solution for Merrill at that point?
I just don't remember at this point. I mean, most of my, over that time, I think I was mainly worrying about tri-party.
Right.
And most of our tri-party solutions, or at least the PDCF-based solutions, were not institution-specific. Right. They were broad. Their facilities that are still allowed under 13.3 Dodd-Frank. And obviously there was some discussion of other things. I wouldn't be shocked to find that in terms of degrees of enthusiasm for considering proposals that might be a little bit more forward-leaning,
right?
And less attentive concerns about too big to fail that the New York Fed might occasionally be ahead of the board.
Yeah.
In
they're closer to the scene of action.
Yes,
right.
Yes. But there's not enough here for me to really opine on that.
Right.
Do you recall generally any discussions in terms of the bank holding company 23A idea? In terms of folks saying we're concerned about the kind of message that might send to the market about
Well, it came up again and again. It came up first with Countrywide. Countrywide wanted to move you know, they had a huge, it originated most of its mortgages through a non-bank sub, and when all of a sudden the non-bank sub, which had financed itself mainly by issuing asset-backed commercial paper, lost access to its asset-backed commercial paper, the answer was simple. Just move all of the assets into its insured DI. But people, and I believe the OTS thought that was a pretty simple answer too, but the Fed and especially the FDIC were not inclined to think that was a good idea. And in their case, what they did, which we didn't oppose, which they, at my recollection, is they shifted the origination of the mortgages from the non-bank sub to the insured DI. So then their problem really was only the mortgages that had been in the pipeline.
The historic ones,
And going forward, they could, like any other insured DI, they could fund that with insured deposits and home loan bank advances. So they did. So it came up in that context. The 23A issues came up time and again throughout the crisis. And, of course, we did grant at various times, various degrees of exemptive relief from 23A, but it really, you know, sort of was dependent on the terms of the particular proposal, and I assume, especially from the FDIC's perspective, the extent to which they saw, and we would have more or less the same perspective, how much risk did it pose to the deposit insurance fund? I mean, even though we may have our eye more than the FDIC and the broader financial stability ball, you still have to do a balancing act, and we certainly wouldn't want to have allowed some broker-dealer to transfer all kinds of crap to an insured DI and then have the insured DI fail and, you know, all the community banks in America get to finance the losses on this outrageous decision that the Fed made. So that would sort of be the issue.
But back in you know, one of the things, of course, we do see is, you know, after Lehman fails and before we get to Wachovia, both Goldman and Morgan do become bank holding companies on that weekend, I think the 21st. But we've heard from folks and seen in the Veloukis report that when this idea was apparently floated in the July 2008 time frame, that Mr. Geithner and others pretty much told Lehman, not a good idea. And not simply because we're concerned about you guys shoving assets into an insured depository institution, but concerned about the message it would send to the street. Do you recall anything?
I don't think I was involved in those, but I'll just make the observation that over the course of 2008, things that were totally unthinkable at the beginning of 2008, some of those became thinkable in March 2008. Some things that were unthinkable in March of 2008 became thinkable in September or October or November 2008 as the crisis deepened. And maybe, you know, for example, one could ask, others have asked, I guess, the question in hindsight, well, we only introduced the PDCF after Bear hit the wall. If you had introduced the PDCF a couple months earlier, might have that have stabilized Bear's funding and never gotten there, da-da-da-da-da. Maybe, but 13.3 was historic. We'd never invoked 13.3 since the Great Depression, and it's hard, I think, to invoke 13.3 to deal with a potential problem as opposed to an actual problem. We would have gotten our brains beaten in for doing it. And then if it worked, they'd say, well, you guys went and opened up the discount window to investment banks to deal with a supposed crisis that didn't occur and in our judgment never would have occurred, so you incurred all this moral hazard for no good reason. You guys are just worthless.
On the issue of expanding the PDCF on Lehman weekend, my understanding is, of course, that the Lehman broker-dealer that came out of that weekend, you know, got access to the expanded PDCF. There's been some disagreement or debate over whether the old Lehman people were told, if you don't file for bankruptcy, you won't get access to the expanded PDCF. Were you party to any of those discussions about whether the expanded PDCF would be made available to the old Lehman if they decided for some reason not to file bankruptcy?
I actually was in some of the meetings with the Lehman people that weekend, but I don't recall that. And again, I'm not sure. Is my view, even if such a statement were made, I'm not sure it would have been made in the meeting I was at.
Right.
Anything else?
I think fine.
Mr. Parkinson, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Well,